but none of these, or any personality disorder, indicated that a subject was crazy. They were, rather, an integral part of the way some people relate to the world.
"He wants to do the case his way?" Upham asked Dr. Hultung. "Is that accurate?"
"Yes. At some point he asked me not to talk to his attorneys. Within a reality-based way, he cited individuals who may be against him. There were many."
"Is he competent to act as his own attorney?"
"I concluded that within the framework of understanding the nature of the procedure, he's perfectly rational," Dr. Hultung replied. "He's at least of high average intelligence. As defined by Oregon law, he has the capacity to assist in his own defense." Oddly, even though this testimony had the potential to damage him more than Dr. True's, Brad was happy with Dr. Hulting's diagnosis. Odder still, clearly seeing this as an opportunity to get many of his complaints into the record, he proceeded to demonstrate his paranoid personality disorder. He complained to Dr. Hulting that Judge Alexander wasn't being fair, that he gave Scott Upham favorable treatment. As Alexander listened without expression, Brad told Hulting that the judge was prosecutorial and more interested in getting me convicted than conducting a fair trial.
"Yes, you told me that," Hulting said calmly. Judge Alexander had a question for Dr. Hulting. "Did you observe Mr. Cunningham going ahead even when I was concerned it was dangerous for him? Doesn't that concern you?"
"Yes," Hulting agreed. "But that's more maladaptive, narcissistic behavior. He isn't delusional."
"What about his inability or failure to recognize danger?" Alexander pressed. "That's just his poor judgment."
Brad continued to complain about several of Judge Alexander's rulings that he felt were unfair, and patiently Dr. Hulting tried to explain to him what the crux of the matter was.
"You and the judge were clearly having a difference of opinion. From where I sit, your view is distorted, but it doesn't fall into crazy because you're not saying the judge is ruling against you because he's receiving messages from Mars. Then I'd be concerned."
For the first time in a very long time, there were smiles in the courtroom. Dr. Hulting's opinion would prevail, and the trial would go on. Brad, poor judgment and all, would continue to conduct his own defense. Lyons and Hunt would continue to try to advise him, and he, in all likelihood, would continue to ignore their advice.
Chapter 63. DNA evidence is an esoteric and recent addition to a criminalist's already impressive knowledge of things seen and not seen by the naked eye at a crime scene. And Cecilia van Beroldingen was one of the outstanding DNA experts in America. She was a pretty, slender young woman whose self-confident movements belied the fact that she was legally blind. She took the stand just after lunch on December 12th, and her seeing-eye dog, a golden retriever, waited for her at the far end of the press row next to investigator Jim Carr, its eyes never leaving its mistress. It took several minutes for Scott Upham to elicit the plethora of credentials that Dr. Van Beroldingen possessed. She gave the jurors a crash course in DNA, explaining that humans normally inherit 23 chromosomes from the male parent and the same number from the female. DNA, the stuff of life, is found in these chromosomes, although there are three basic methods, namely RLFP, PCR, and DQ-alpha, used to extract, amplify, and evaluate DNA. She told the jury that she had used the DQ-alpha typing process on the hairs preserved as evidence after Cheryl's murder. With blood samples taken from both Brad and Cheryl, von Beroldingen was able to establish that they had different DQ-alpha profiles. Cheryl's was 1.33, while Brad's was 1.24, she said. The only thing that Van Beraldingen had had to work with were the hair follicles. Two hairs had been found on Cheryl's arm and blouse, hairs that still had the root or follicle attached. The hair shaft itself cannot be tested for DNA components, but the tag or follicle can. The hair found on Cheryl's forearm was consistent with Cheryl's 1.33 DQ alpha profile, but the human cellular contaminant on it was Brad's type, 1.24. This contaminant could be anything from sweat to blood to mucus to semen or any other bodily secretion. That would indicate that someone with a 1.24 DQ alpha profile had been in contact with the hair found on Cheryl's body. It would be essential for the defense to establish what percentage of the population had 1.24 DQ alpha profiles, and Kevin Hunt had planned to cross-examine Von Beraldingen. Judge Alexander ruled that he couldn't. Brad had chosen to defend himself, and he couldn't have it both ways. Hunt would be allowed only to whisper questions while Brad himself cross-examined Dr. Van Beraldingen. With his first question, however, an interesting phenomenon took place. Although his voice was as soft and conciliatory as it usually was when he questioned witnesses, there was apparently something in it that raised the hairs on the back of Cecilia Van Beraldingen's dog. The perfectly trained animal leaned forward and growled deep in its throat, a sound that not one in the courtroom missed. Brad had always been a quick study, and he had apparently boned up on DNA. The DNA pattern revealed during Van Beraldingen's tests, he submitted, was not that unique. In fact, he managed to establish that approximately 1 out of 10 Caucasians in the greater Portland area also had the same DQ alpha genotype that Brad did. It was not as if he had left a fingerprint on Cheryl's flesh, a fingerprint that was absolutely unique to him. Von Beraldingen could only say that he was among the 10% of the population who could have left the contaminants on the retrieved hairs, as opposed to the 90% with other DQ alpha genotypes who could not. This was physical evidence to be considered with the circumstantial evidence that pointed to Brad, but it was not conclusive. There were fireworks later in the day when the defense's DNA expert, Randall Libby, testified. Brad's questions and Libby's answers seemed to meld too well, and a suspicious Upham raised an objection. It turned out that Libby had prepared 7.5 pages of questions, including many of the answers he planned to give for Brad to use. Upham said that the list should have been shared with the prosecutor, and that the fact that it was not was a violation of discovery. Judge Alexander sent the jury out, and when they were gone, he ruled that Libby's testimony and the list that Upham called crib notes were indeed a violation of discovery. Randall Libby and his testimony disappeared from the trial. When the jury returned, he was gone, and no explanation for his absence was given. Brad moved once again for a mistrial. Motion denied. Brad took the witness stand for a second time on December 14th. He was once again both witness and defense attorney as he continued his direct examination of himself. He spoke for more than 2 hours, focusing on the good times and bad times of his marriage to Cheryl. On a number of occasions, he choked up and seemed about to burst into tears as he remembered his love for Cheryl. His emotions were still evanescent, however, gone in an instant. Strangely, his grief didn't prevent him from harping on Cheryl's promiscuity. Again and again, he told the jury that she was having sexual relationships with 7 or 8 men at the time of her death. "That didn't make her a bad person," he said generously. "It didn't bother me." With a half-smile of sad acceptance, he said only that he had worried because he didn't think Cheryl's affairs left her much time to care for their three sons. Brad insisted that he was home with his sons all the Sunday evening in question, except for two quick runs with Michael to the parking garage. He estimated he hadn't been out of his apartment for more than 10 minutes total. "I was trying to run off his energy," he said of Michael. "He was very hyper that evening." He denied that he gave conflicting stories of his whereabouts and activities to a number of different people. "I am telling you today," he said earnestly to the jurors, his voice quavering, "I did not kill Cheryl." Just as Judge Alexander had warned him, Brad was now fair game for the prosecution. Scott Upham had memorized the convoluted transfers of homes, land, building materials, heavy equipment, guns, and vehicles that Brad had accomplished. He had already been relentless in questioning some of Brad's attorneys and accountants, and now he was harder on Brad himself. Many of Brad's holdings had never been disclosed to the bankruptcy court. This, Upham maintained, was one of Brad's reasons to want Cheryl dead. She had been about to expose his financial machinations. Now, Upham did what Cheryl had been unable to do. He held those transactions up to the light. Brad had a hard time explaining how trucks and trailers and guns changed hands on paper, but apparently not in reality. The Prowler trailer that had eventually been purchased by Sarah had bounced all over Washington State without ever once actually moving. Paperwork showed that Brad had given it to a law firm to pay for attorney's fees, then bought it back, then given it to his father. It seemed to have been the same with Brad's guns and expensive cameras. He fumbled when he tried to remember where they had all gone. "We had 50 guns. Some went to a gun shop on consignment, some to his law firm. He wasn't quite sure. When Upham pointed out bankruptcy report irregularities, Brad had a ready answer. "Cheryl filled those out," he said. Upham was also fascinated with Brad's tax returns, returns that Brad seemed to have forgotten. During the years when he had brought in virtually no income, he had taken huge deductions for business expenses. Cheryl had also threatened to expose his tax dodges to the IRS, heightening his motive for murder. Brad's face glistened with sweat as he tried to answer Upham's increasingly intricate questions. At the same time, he took notes to help him with his own redirect testimony. Brad wasn't concerned with questions about his sex life. He readily admitted to having affairs with his babysitter Marnie and with Lilia Sarnan. As for his other co-worker, Karen Aborg, he was disdainful. "She would come to my apartment, and she was a date I couldn't get to go home. She wanted sex, so I did. I only slept with her so she'd go home." "You have a facetious sense of humor?" Upham asked suddenly, changing the subject. "Yes," Brad said warily. "The poison plot was a joke?" Upham asked incredulously. "Cheryl and I thought it was a joke," he said, then added, "but it was like Betty, to poison me and take the kids to Arkansas and hide them so Cheryl could live the kind of life she wanted until she wanted them back." It was obvious to everyone watching that Brad was not only in deep water, he was way over his head. Upham hit him again and again with questions that demanded precise answers, and Brad could no longer tailor his answers to fit the facts and make them sound like anything but fiction. Even so, he wouldn't show that he was in the least rattled. He continued to write down each question Upham asked him. He was alternately insolent and bored. He ignored Upham as much as anyone on the witness stand could ignore the attorney who was verbally pummeling him up one side of the courtroom and down the other. Brad choked up as he said he had cried when he learned how Cheryl had died.
Finch said she had been bludgeoned. "You understand my state of mind," he said. "I was nauseous. I was actually weaving. I threw up a little in my hand and ran for the bathroom." Had he forgotten Jim Eyre's testimony that he had shown virtually no emotion upon learning that Cheryl was dead, and that neither he nor Finch had told Brad how Cheryl died? Again and again, Upham tripped Brad up. On times, on whom he had talked to the night of the murder and when. Even on what snacks he fed his children and what was on television. Brad was angry, but controlled. "You were wearing a yellow and orange vest when Jess opened the door?" Upham asked. "No. You didn't tell Jess you'd been jogging around Sarah's hospital?" "No." "You washed up in the kitchen?" "No," Brad said. He had put an old pair of shoes and pants in Sarah's car because he had to test soil on land in Tigard the next day. He had planned to pick up his Suburban at Providence Hospital early the next morning. Upham asked a question that surprised Brad. "Who was going to take care of Philip?" Brad looked puzzled. "You didn't call anyone Sunday night to take care of Philip Monday morning?" He had not. The inference was, of course, that Brad knew that this Monday morning would be different, that there would be no need for routine babysitting. Brad wanted to talk instead about the many loads of laundry he had done in his apartment Sunday night. "I did a lot of wash. I was staying busy," he said. "I was having a good time with my sons." Brad's answers were making less and less sense. Now, in response to many of Upham's questions, he evaded answering and talked instead of the destruction of his life by everyone. He could count on no one. He had been fired after Cheryl's murder. Yes, Sarah had paid some of his legal fees, but he had paid her back. Bob McNanny withheld trust funds from the boys, so he had had to borrow from the Colville tribe. He had had no choice but to let Sarah adopt his sons so Betty wouldn't get them. Sarah didn't want children. "I wish I hadn't done it." Upham showed Brad the letter in which he begged Sarah not to divorce him. "I wasn't going to talk about certain things," Brad said, "but it looks like I'll have to." He smiled. "It appeared she was seeing other men. Want to hear about it?" Brad had slipped into a familiar refrain, but Upham didn't encourage it. Instead, he asked if there was another reason for his divorce from Sarah, and Brad said that his marriage began to disintegrate when the tax thing started to fall apart. "In 1990? Upham asked. "Before," Brad replied. "We had tax problems. There were certain accusations, certain disclosures." Upham asked Brad if he recalled a stipulated money judgment and dissolution of marriage document he had signed on September 21, 1991, ironically on the fifth anniversary of Cheryl's murder. In that document, Brad had admitted to most of Sarah's accusations and agreed to pay her a $50,000 judgment against him. "The boys got the farm," Brad said vaguely. "I don't remember the $50,000 judgment. I can't remember certain events taking place, can't remember denying Sarah visits and phone calls with the children. I just wanted out. I wanted nothing to do with her." Upham remarked that Brad's divorce from Sarah was eerily reminiscent of the last days of his marriage to Cheryl. Brad didn't get it. He said that he suspected Sarah of drugging his children to control them. "I still do. They're like Stepford children. My boys have one mother, Cheryl." Upham had cross-examined Brad for 3 hours. He was unruffled, but Brad looked exhausted, stress tightening his face into a deeply lined mask. When the letters that he had been sending to his sons while they were living with Sarah were admitted into evidence, Brad panicked. He didn't want the envelopes in evidence. Anyone who had seen those envelopes understood why.
Judge Alexander allowed Brad to hold back the envelopes with their vicious and suggestive cartoons. And when court recessed, he grabbed for the stack of letters and hurriedly ripped the envelope off each one. On redirect, Brad took the stand to try to patch up the huge rents Upham had torn in his case. His own explanations were really all he had. The witnesses from his long list never materialized. Now, to refute the prosecution's witnesses, he launched another tirade against the women in his life. He hinted that Sarah was a lesbian who was using her money to keep his sons from him. "It's been the boys and me, and now Sarah has the children. We're going to sue Sarah and get our farm back together. The boys and I will be back together." Judge Alexander warned Brad that he was sliding toward closing argument rather than giving testimony. Ignoring the warning, Brad again listed the faults of Lonnie Ann, Cynthia, Lauren, and, of course, Cheryl. He covered old territory, oblivious to the damage he was inflicting on his case, as, once again, the details about his whereabouts and activities on the night of the murder changed slightly. Brad apparently feared that the jury had noticed his security leg brace because he explained to them that he had a bad leg and wore a brace. "I had cancer of the bone when I was little, but it got better so I could play football in high school and college." He was rambling, and Alexander was running out of patience. He warned Brad to finish up. "I've done a lot of depositions," Brad said. "I've always tried to be honest." Judge Alexander warned him again. When Brad veered back into his financial affairs and once again began to quote dollar figures, Alexander told him that there was no need to recover old ground. He looked at Upham and said, "Any request for recross will be viewed with great disfavor." "No questions," Upham said wisely. Brad wanted to call Judge Alexander as a witness, and Alexander explained that the judge of a trial cannot be called to the stand. "I'm not sure that's your call," Brad said rudely. "Well, in my courtroom it is. You've rested your case," Alexander said flatly. "I move for a judgment of acquittal," Brad said. "Denied." Only Alexander had managed to keep the trial from becoming a Keystone Court, and he tried again to save Brad from his own ferocious ego. He offered him one more chance to change his plea from not guilty to manslaughter in the first degree. "This would be your last chance," Alexander said. "Murder is life in the penitentiary with various minimums." Brad huddled with Kevin Hunt, who obviously was urging him to take the judge's advice. But Brad would have none of it. He was going for a straight, not guilty verdict. Chapter 64. It was 3:27 p.m., 3 days before Christmas Eve, and at last the time had come for final arguments. Although few knew it, Scott Upham was suffering from a violent case of 48-hour flu that day. But his voice never betrayed his queasy stomach and pounding headache, and when a wave of dizziness hit him, he managed to make holding on to the lectern look like a strong posture rather than a need for support. He had not come this far to back off now. Upham told the jury that their job was to decide what was worthy of belief and what was not, what was relevant and what was not. They must consider direct evidence, such as eyewitness testimony, and circumstantial evidence, a chain of circumstances pointing to an obvious conclusion. "Murder is the intentional taking of the life of a human being," he said. "I'm here to tell you the defendant is guilty of murder." It would take 12 jurors to convict and only 10 to acquit. With flawless memory, Upham went over the story of the lives of Brad and Cheryl. He had done so back in October when the trial began, and now the story was familiar and the jury had a chance to judge for themselves who was telling the truth. "Cheryl was scared," Upham said. "She changed her will, the beneficiary of her life insurance." Gesturing toward Brad, he said, "This is the public Mr. Cunningham. Cheryl knew the private Mr. Cunningham, the temper, selfish, no empathy, competitive. He's willing to act on his propensity to destroy, feels very comfortable, very at ease in hurting other people. The kids are my possessions." Cheryl wanted peace. What an enemy he was, relentless. He has staying power, and he'll do anything to get his way. What a horror Cheryl had lived through. This jury had never, and would never, hear about what Brad had done to his first three wives, not in a criminal case. But they had come to know Cheryl, and their eyes moved from Upham to Brad as Upham spoke. "The note," Cheryl left, "and her conversation with Betty were sufficient to convict," he said. "But there's more." He listed the strongest points of an already strong case. Brad's threatening and obsessive behavior before Cheryl's murder, his inconsistent alibis for the time of her death, his flight to evade questioning. "He told Sarah on Monday evening," Upham said. "I'd better not answer. I'm digging too many holes, and I've got too many holes to fill now." Upham recalled all the people Brad had accused of lying. Karen Aborg, Jim Ayers, Dr. Sardo, Jess, Jim Carr, Sarah. "Finally, he says Cheryl lied to her mother and her brother in her last note. The innocent do not behave like that. The innocent don't have to lie to that degree. He viciously murdered Cheryl Keaton, and he's lied. He lured Cheryl Keaton from the safety of her home. Because of her love for those children, she went. Cheryl has told us what the truth is in her conversation with her mother and in her note. Bradley Morris Cunningham murdered me." Brad and Upham had been allotted a total of 2 hours each for final arguments. Upham could speak once more. Brad could speak only once, and he was clearly nervous. But he had now formulated a timetable for the night of the murder that warred with that established by the Oregon State Police and Mike Shinn and Upham and his staff. By adding a few minutes here and shaving a few there, he set out to prove the prosecution wrong. As he spoke, Brad warmed to his subject and became animated. He insisted that, had he been the killer, there would have been a window of only 9 minutes and 48 seconds in which he could have driven from the death site back to the Madison Tower, disposed of his bloody clothing, driven through the gate, parked, gone up the elevator, and unlocked the door with a 4-year-old boy in tow. He asked, "How could you get back to the mobile station that fast?" "I don't run 4-minute miles. It would take at least 7 minutes to run back." "No," he insisted, "his Sunday evening had not been spent the way Upham said. He could account for every minute of the time between 7:30 and 10. "I made popcorn. Michael and I had to leave the room because he couldn't settle down. I left to get blankets out of the car. We'd race like that. Zip here, zip there." He said he had changed into shorts and a T-shirt because that was comfortable. "And I felt I looked good. Cheryl was coming over to see my apartment." There were no dishes to wash, Brad said, but Michael had helped him wash 3 or 4 loads of laundry. "He'd pour in the soap and I'd throw the clothes in the dryer." Female jurors exchanged glances. 3 or 4 loads of laundry would have taken at least 4 hours. But Brad was on a roll now and seemed to be enjoying himself. He became magnanimous as he smiled at the jurors. "All you wonderful people had to sit here so long because I didn't know they'd bring in income tax fraud and bankruptcy. I thought we had a 5-to-10-day case.
98% of the time, I'm happy with court decisions because it's fair. I am litigious.
He talked of items that Cheryl and her brother had hidden from the bankruptcy court. She was committing bankruptcy fraud by giving away the bronze moose head, my Rolex, the stereo, the Nikon camera, and I was about to depose some of her partners. It was the right time to paint me black. Cheryl wasn't a little wallflower. She was fully apprised of everything we did.
The transformation that took place in Judge Alexander's courtroom was fascinating, as Brad obviously felt he had the jury in the palm of his hand. He was alternately sarcastic and expansive.
"I wanted custody, so I killed my wife," he said, almost laughing. "That's ludicrous. I wasn't interested in full custody. You had to go for the whole enchilada? I didn't want it. I was president of a $17 million company. My life was good. All I wanted to show the judge was that Cheryl couldn't be the primary parent. She had to spend time with Mr. Sloan, Mr. Miller, Mr. Thomas, Mr. Green, etc. She didn't have time to be the primary parent."
Brad smiled winningly. "I tend to be too analytical. I tend to be too practical," he said. "I'm not a day at the beach sometimes. Today I stand before you only 10% of the man I was 2 or 3 years ago. I'm more introspective. Cheryl was a good mother. She was going through a cycle. I was, too. I was coming out. She got her licks in with her affairs with guys at the office. My life was back on track in September 1986. I was on a career track. My kids were happy. I was making $80,000 a year, and I was dating Dr. Gordon. I'm a person who has fiscal responsibility. I always have been."
Suddenly, Brad's charismatic smile faded as he talked of the pictures of Cheryl after she was dead.
"I never saw those pictures before," he said. "They do that to shock you and upset you. It bothers me. They have no right to take pictures of Cheryl and show them like that. It's a stunt."
His voice faltered and he began to cry.
"Believe me, the police officers have a set, too. You have to find me not guilty. You have to look at the facts."
Brad continued to sob.
"I loved Cheryl. I loved her in August of 1986.
His tears caught in his throat.
"I loved her in September of 1986.
His voice dropped dramatically.
"I can still hear her say, "Possession is 9 points of the law." I'm also a little naive. I always have been. I'm always a little shocked. Cheryl lied in her deposition."
Spectators were transfixed by his performance.
"I don't have to prove anything," Brad said softly. "But I tried to.
This was not a life experience I want, but I had a duty to my children. This was incredible. I had no idea it would be like this technically. I'm not very proficient, and Judge Alexander got mad at me."
Brad spoke of depraved indifference as he stood before the jury, but Judge Alexander called it a day for him. He would have the rest of his 2 hours in the morning, and when he resumed his final argument, Brad explained that he had only wanted to put Michael on the stand, his alibi witness, but the judge hadn't allowed it. He said he had just begun to understand the way the trial should go when it was all over. And once again, he went down the list of those he blamed.
"Your time is up," Judge Alexander interrupted. "Make some concluding remarks."
"Think about Cheryl's life," Brad said earnestly. "Strange stuff. I had no motive. This was Mom. This is Mom. I can tell you on the health of my children, I would never have killed their mom."
Scott Upham rose to give the prosecution's final argument. He looked at the jurors, whose faces were as impassive as all jurors are. Had they believed any of Brad's histrionics? There was always the danger of finding out that one or two jurors had bought a story that seemed, to Upham, patently false. He never quit until it was really all over. Still a little pale around the gills, he began, "This isn't about theories. This is about truth." Upham commented that real people didn't have stopwatches as they went about their lives. All of Brad's careful manipulation of times was not enough to change the facts. There was no question, he said, that Cheryl was terribly upset when she called her mother shortly after 7 on Sunday night. The month of September had been especially brutal for her. All the incidents added to her fear and apprehension. Even changing time slightly, Upham said. The defendant clearly had the opportunity to do what Cheryl said he would do. That's sufficient to find him guilty of murder. Brad had deliberately staged a car wreck, he said. Hadn't his first question to Jim Ayers been, "Did she die in a traffic accident?" "No," Ayers had said. Upham speculated about what Brad must have thought. "Damn! Now what do I do?" "To believe he didn't do this crime," Upham said, "Cheryl's note would have had to be a lie. Her call to Betty would have to be a lie. She'd have to lie to Jim Carr at 7:30. She deliberately lied 3 times." And then, Upham pointed out, Sarah had, of course, lied about her calls to Brad that went unanswered. Marv Trosseth's calls weren't answered either, so that would make him a liar, too. The last lie was when Jess unlocked the door and Brad said, "I've been jogging around Sarah's hospital." That makes 9 lies told by 4 different people, Upham said. Jess, Cheryl, Marv, and Sarah. "I believe Mr. Cunningham is unworthy of your attention." Brad's furious objection was sustained. "Brad's lie," Upham continued, undeterred, "was, 'I'm excited about showing her, Cheryl, my digs, even though I'm destroying her in the divorce with the kids and ruining her partner's reputation.'" He listed all the people who had to be wrong for Brad to be right, and the list encompassed almost everyone he had been in contact with, or who had seen him when he hadn't wanted to be seen, on the night Cheryl died. "Mr. Cunningham is willing to say anything under any circumstances to suit his convenience. Cheryl's note, the phone calls, the timeline witnesses, his behavior after Cheryl's murder, and his contradictory statements all point to guilt," Upham said. "The autopsy shows that Cheryl Keaton was savagely murdered, but there was no sexual attack, and it was not robbery. The motive was pure hatred." "And he left his calling card," Upham added. "His DNA." Upham said that the only person who hated Cheryl was Bradley Morris Cunningham. Brad objected and was overruled. Upham's final argument was getting to Brad, and he objected constantly until Judge Alexander reminded him, "This is closing argument." "Everybody's out to get Mr. Cunningham," Upham said wearily. "He consistently and relentlessly lies. It just wears me out to think of them all. I'm not going to try." Upham picked up a handful of the letters that Brad had sent to Jess, Michael, and Philip from jail. While Sarah cared for his children, he had clearly tried to destroy their trust in her. As Upham read excerpts, the jurors' faces and body language reflected shock for the first time in the trial. "I worry about you. Sarah is destroying our father and son relationship. Her sick black soul controls you with money. Dearest sons, things are going really well, maybe her reign is nearing the end. Dear sons, she is sweating her butt off. She is praying to her black god, her devil master. I think her condition is becoming critical and terminal. Brad slouched in his chair, quietly enraged, his jaw working as Upham wound up his remarks. He's a master of trickery and deceit. He has special talents. It's okay for him to lie, to violate court rules, to destroy her family, to destroy Cheryl's memory. Okay to destroy innocent motorists on Highway 26 to cover his tracks. But he can't overcome all the witnesses and evidence. You do not need to be afraid, Upham told the jury. Cheryl Keaton has told us what the truth is. I went to meet Brad Cunningham on September 21st, 1986, to get my kids, but he tricked me and savagely beat me. Chapter 65. Brad had changed his mind, probably with Kevin Hunt's urging, and allowed Judge Alexander to include the criteria for a finding of manslaughter in the first degree, as well as for murder, as he read the instructions to the jury. He was, perhaps, not as confident as he had been before Upham's final argument. He slouched deeper in his chair and leaned to one side with his jaw resting on splayed fingers. Listening had always been difficult for him. He seemed to have felt his words were convincing, but now he appeared apprehensive. The two alternate jurors, not needed, were dismissed, and the jurors filed out to deliberate. It was so close to the noon break that no one expected they would begin to discuss the case until early afternoon. The regulars in the courtroom walked out into the chilly air and headed toward the Copperstone restaurant. For an hour or two, the tension would be gone. Too early to worry about a verdict. Seated at tables were Betty and Marv Trosseth, Susan and Dave Keegan, Bob McNanny, Jack Kincaid, Debbie and Billy Bowen, Kim and Bill Roberts, Mike Shin, Katana King, Donna Anders, and myself. Sarah Gordon was too nervous to be present, and, besides, she wanted to be with her sons when the verdict came in. Nobody ate much, and conversation was determinedly cheerful while Christmas songs played on the Muzak and Hillsborough shoppers passed by outside, intent on finding last-minute gifts. Most of the trial-goers had yet to buy a first present for anyone. It was as if their lives had been suspended until they knew if Brad would be convicted or walk free. If he did walk free, there would be no Christmas for Sarah. The first thing Brad would do was come and take his sons away from her. She had no doubt about that. There wasn't much happening on the fourth floor of the Washington County Courthouse when we all returned. A few days before, there had been two murder trials, Brad Cunningham's and Caesar Barone's. Now Barone, a suspected serial killer, had been convicted of the murder of nurse midwife Martha Browning Bryant, and Brad waited in his jail suite for the verdict in his case. The only courtroom that wasn't dark that long Friday afternoon handled civil cases, and the complainants and witnesses came and went as a score or more of people waited for the Cunningham jury to return. Experienced court watchers say a quick verdict is a guilty verdict. The longer the time that passes, the more likely an acquittal. The afternoon dragged on. When the clock over the public phone read 2 and then 3, we all began to grow nervous. How long did it take to poll 12 jurors? What were they doing in there? The most nervous paced the circular route past the elevators, the wall hanging, the civil courtroom, the waiting room, the phones, the water fountain, and around again. Of them all, Jack Kincaid was the steadiest pacer, stopping only long enough to call Sarah every hour and, with great acting ability, reassure her that it looked great for a conviction. Did it? Nobody knew. To pass the time, everyone put up a dollar and guessed an exact time the jury would come back. The pot held more than $20. Cheryl's sister Susan, happily pregnant with her first child, was designated the most reliable person to hold the money. At 4 o'clock, the jury had been out for 5 hours. Allowing even an hour and a half for lunch, that still left them more than 3 hours to deliberate. Nerves began to fray. Kincaid was joined on his circular pacing route by a half dozen others, and stern court guards stepped out of the civil courtroom and shushed them. The word was that the jury wouldn't stay after 6 to deliberate, and the thought of having to wait overnight was agonizing. Cheryl's California relatives had small children who were looking forward to Christmas, and they would have to leave. But somehow everyone felt that it was essential to wait, that being there in the hallway was the last thing they could do for Cheryl, even knowing that it couldn't really matter. The jury was locked in its own cocoon behind so many doors. It didn't look good. It was almost 5, and all the pool guessers had long since passed the time they had picked, all but Marv Trosseth. And then Jerry Wells, the courtroom deputy who had always been full of jokes and irreverent remarks, walked back to where Cheryl's family and a few reporters waited. For once, he was entirely serious, and he looked worried. "Whenever the jury comes back," he said slowly, "I want you all to know that there are to be no demonstrations, no remarks, no noise. I'll have to ask you to leave the courtroom if you can't live by those rules." "Is the jury coming back?" somebody asked. "I didn't say that," Wells said carefully. "When it does, I'm telling you that I mean that I don't care how much I like you. Anybody who acts up is out." He looked straight at Billy Bowen, Cheryl's tall, husky brother-in-law, as he spoke. Billy grew emotional whenever he thought that Cheryl had had no one to help her. Now he looked back at Jerry and nodded slightly. He wouldn't cause any trouble. Something was happening. The elevator doors opened, and Kevin Hunt and Tim Lyons stepped out and hurried into Susie Doody's office. Word was that Scott Upham and Jim Carr were on their way up the back stairs from the DA's office. The short corridor outside Judge Alexander's courtroom, where spectators had lined up every day for 2 months, was suddenly full of people, some leaning against the wall, others sitting on the floor, waiting. It was 5:15 p.m. on Thursday, December 22, 1994, and everyone sensed there would be no overnight wait. At 5:24, a bell began to ding in Susie's office. The jury was back. The jury had a verdict. At 5:40, Cheryl's family sat together in the back row of the courtroom and held hands as they fought to contain their emotions. Brad was sitting at the defense table with Hunt and Lyons. Upham at his table. Judge Alexander glanced at the gallery and repeated the warning that Jerry Wells had given. There were to be no outbursts when the verdict was read. Either way it went, it would be difficult to keep silent after 8 years of waiting. The jury filed in silently and took their seats. "Have you reached a verdict?" Judge Alexander asked. "We have, Your Honor," jury foreman Robert Wilcoxon said, and handed the findings to Bailiff Susie Doody. She handed it to Judge Alexander, who read it without expression, and returned it to Susie. Silently and quickly, court security officers Jerry Wells, Trish DeLand, and J.C. Crossland had moved to stand behind Brad, creating a barrier between him and the first row of the gallery where reporters waited, pens poised. "We find the defendant, Bradley Morris Cunningham," she read, "guilty of murder." Brad sat slouched in his chair, his face turned away from the spectators, but he shook his head very slowly back and forth as if to say, "This is all a terrible mistake." Upham didn't ask for a poll of the jurors, but Brad wanted it done. One by one they looked at him as they repeated guilty until the 12th guilty hung on the air.
"It was over so quickly," Susan Keegan remembered. "After all those years, it was over. When I walked out of the courtroom, Jim Carr grabbed me and took me over to Scott. Scott had tears in his eyes, and I hugged him. I just kept saying to him, 'You never gave up. You never gave up.'"
While television cameras focused on Cheryl's family, Jerry Wells and Trish DeLand waited to lead Brad back to jail. Betty Trosseth cried, too, as she told reporters,
"Cheryl believed in the justice system, and now I know it works."
For the first time in his life, perhaps, Brad Cunningham had lost and lost big. Jerry Wells observed that he could barely stand, his legs turned to rubber by shock. To no one in particular, Brad asked,
"Has anyone ever come back here on appeal?"
Wells looked away, but Trish DeLand said,
"Yeah, a woman did, and she got convicted the second time, too."
Jack Kincaid rushed to the phone to tell Sarah that she would have her sons with her for Christmas, that, in all likelihood, she would have her sons with her until they grew to be men. While everyone outside was agonizing about what they were doing, the jurors had taken a quick vote when they first retired to deliberate. That vote was 8 for guilty and 4 undecided. They didn't vote again until 45 minutes before they returned with their verdict. At that point, just as everyone waiting was beginning to panic, Will Coxon counted 11 guilties and tore up the 12th, his own. He knew he had voted guilty. It had been a long, hard afternoon for them, and many of the women had cried because of the tremendous responsibility they felt. For all of Upham's research into Brad's checkered financial background, he later learned that the jurors didn't give a hoot about all the bankruptcy stuff, and they weren't impressed by the DNA. None of them had cared for Brad, but they knew they couldn't render a verdict on whether they liked him or not. What had really made up their minds was the testimony from the silent witness. Cheryl's last note and her conversation with her mother right before she left the house to go meet her killer were the two pieces of evidence that the jurors had found totally convincing. In 5 hours, it would be Christmas Eve. The snow had all disappeared and the air was cold and smoky with fog. Cheryl's family headed toward Longview for their 8th Christmas without her, but somehow it would not be so bad now. Celebrants wandered back to the Copperstone, still almost stunned that it was over and that it was okay. Scott Upham, Mike McKernan, and Jim Carr had a beer, and Upham enjoyed a good cigar. Mike Shinn and Upham shook hands as Shinn complimented Upham on his remarkably convincing final arguments. By tomorrow, everyone who had been together daily for months would be scattered, off to their real lives in 3 states. On January 6, 1995, the group reassembled for the last time. Brad was to be sentenced that afternoon for the crime of murder. Now that he had been convicted, Upham could present witnesses about prior bad acts he had committed and reveal incidents and behavior that might affect the length of his sentence. 2 women from his past, women Brad had not expected, were in the courtroom. Dana Malloy took the witness stand, a glamorous figure with masses of long blonde hair dressed in what looked to be a $1,000 outfit. She was so frightened to be there, less than a dozen feet from Brad, that her voice was barely audible. Even the sound of a reporter's pen on paper drowned out her words. Brad's life with Dana had been a secret thing, and the jurors had never heard about how he indoctrinated her into the world of topless dancing. Now, with Upham's gentle urging, she told it all. The nights in Houston, the times the little boys were left alone, and Brad's bizarre actions and threats, how he had told her that a psychic had predicted she would commit suicide.
When Brad rose to cross-examine his former mistress, Dana looked at him with apprehension. She had reason to. He immediately set out to characterize her as working for the Seattle Mafia.
"I tried to set you and your mother up in your own business space as cosmetologists, didn't I?" he asked. "I was concerned for your safety."
She stared back at him.
"No."
Brad reminded her that he had found her and her lover, Nick Ronzini, having sex, and he had thrown them out of his apartment.
"You're twisting everything around," Dana said.
"And I put your things down the hall?"
"No. You took everything I owned and put it in the dumpster," she said.
In the back of the courtroom, a new spectator, a very tall, slender young woman with black hair and round, European-style black sunglasses, leaned forward, listening intently. Brad insisted that Dana had been told exactly what to say by the Oregon State Police and the DA's office, and she would not agree. Nor would she agree that he had hired the Blue Moon Detective Agency to find her only because he was worried about her and thought something had happened to her. Brad was determined to show that Dana was a prostitute, but Judge Alexander stopped him, saying that her job had nothing to do with her credibility.
"You make over $200,000 a year, don't you?" Brad pushed on. "I don't know what you're talking about," Dana said.
Finally, Dana's voice rose to a pitch everyone in the courtroom could hear.
"Brad, do you really want to get into this?"
Apparently, he did not. Dana looked at Brad with an almost unreadable expression.
"I thought you were God," she said quietly.
It was obvious she no longer did. Scott Upham asked Dana about the times Brad had followed John Burke, Cheryl's old friend and the administrator of her estate. "Did he say he wanted to kill John Burke?" After a long hesitation, Dana said,
"Yes."
Upham wanted to be sure that Brad stayed in prison as long as possible under the guidelines that were extant for the crime of murder in Oregon in 1986. He had another surprise witness, Ronald O. Marachi, a private investigator whom Brad had hired in the summer of 1994, only months before his trial for murder. He testified that Brad had paid him $2,000 at $40 an hour and paid by check.
"What did he want you to do for him?" Upham asked.
Marachi said that Brad had hired him to buy a truck, a camper, a .30-30 rifle, and some handguns. He said he would need all those things when he was acquitted of murder and got out of jail. He planned to pick up his three sons and travel with them, and, of course, they would need the truck and the weapons. It was Sarah's worst nightmare, although she hadn't known that Brad was actually making preparations to disappear with the boys. Upham rose to ask for the stiffest sentence possible.
"The pattern started early in his life," he said. "He has very little regard for other people or rules. He will do anything he has to get what he wants. He should not ever be allowed to be free. As he sits here, he has no family. He has no friends. He has a character disorder, and it can't be fixed."
Brad also made a brief statement.
"I would not benefit from long-term incarceration," he said, "because I am a caring person."
Unfortunately, Judge Alexander was bound by statute, and he couldn't be sure that Brad would never be free. He could sentence him to life in prison, but the only discretion he had was to raise the mandated 10-year minimum to 25 years. He set the minimum at 22 years. Brad would not be eligible for parole until 2014, and if he was still alive, he would be 68 at that time.
that the attack was premeditated and carefully planned, the viciousness of the attack, Mr. Cunningham's total lack of remorse and repeated false statements by Mr. Cunningham, were all factors Alexander took into account. The only mitigating factor he found was that Brad had no prior criminal record. Brad assured the judge that he would appeal his sentence within 30 days. As the spectators filed out, the tall young woman in the back row moved out into the hall. The mention of Dana's possessions being thrown into a dumpster had been all too familiar to her. It was Kate Cunningham, who was now 25. Despite her father's predictions in Houston that she would never amount to anything, Kate had grown up to be a willowy beauty, a model in Paris. She had come back to witness her father's downfall and to tell him in person, adult to adult, what she thought of him and his treatment of the frightened little girl she had once been. As she had with all Brad's children, Sarah had opened up her home and Kate was staying with her. Later, she visited Brad in the visitors' area of the jail and blasted him with the pent-up emotion of many years. Brad asked not to stay in the Washington County Jail any longer than necessary. He was anxious to move down to Salem, to the Oregon State Penitentiary. That request was granted. Afterward, Sarah wanted to buy something happy to celebrate the fact that she and her sons would no longer have to be afraid. When she learned of the guilty verdict, she chose a figure of Santa Claus in his workshop, executed to precise scale with toys and ornaments and sugar plums. It was a symbolic purchase that meant they would be together not just for the Christmas of 1994, but forever. And as the months passed, the rift between Sarah and Jack Kincaid narrowed, and it was obvious that they, too, would be together when the time was right. Sarah still works in the anesthesiology department at Providence Hospital. On weekends, she usually attends baseball games and other events the boys are involved in. Brent Cunningham lives with her and his brothers and goes to school. When Sarah cannot be there, he is with Jess, Michael, and Philip. Scott Upham is involved in another convoluted murder case, but he and Mary Ann Upham finally managed to break ground on their new house in May 1995. Jim Carr was involved in a horrendous accident in February 1995 when a felon speeding from a police chase slammed broadside into the driver's side door of his car. He is recovering after emergency surgery. Mike Shin is back out on the Columbia River sailboarding. He bought some hilltop property in Hawaii where he plans one day to build a house. In the meantime, he has more cases than he can handle, and he presents trial seminars with criminal defense attorney Jerry Spence. Susan McNanny Keegan gave birth to a baby girl, Anna Marie Keegan, in May 1995. She would have loved to share Anna Marie with Cheryl, and she had always believed that accidents of birth had hastened her sister's death. "The thing that killed Cheryl," she said, "was that she gave Brad 3 boy children, and she tried to keep them. If she had only had one child, a girl, she'd be here today. If Lonnie Ann had had 2 boys instead of a boy and a girl, she'd be dead now. If Lauren had had a boy instead of Amy, she'd be dead. But Cheryl had 3 boys." Bob McNanny still lives in Longview, and he dotes on the only child of his only child. Marv and Betty Trosseth have moved away from Longview. Betty still works as a therapist for the mentally ill. Lonnie Ann Cunningham is hoping to move back to the Northwest now that she no longer has to hide from Brad. Rosemary Cunningham Kinney died in 1993 in Washington. To the end of her long illness, she hoped that Brad might call her. One cousin says, "I think he did call, but she was already gone."
Kate Cunningham stood at her grandmother's grave and gave a eulogy after telling the minister, "You didn't know my grandmother. How can you speak of her?"
Brad Cunningham found that the Oregon State Penitentiary was not much more to his liking than the Washington County Jail. Two long-timers who had been in the jail at the same time he was remembered that he had snitched them off about their secret places for hiding cigarettes. A few weeks after he got to the Salem prison, he was eating lunch in the chow hall when a convict walking down the row popped him in the face and broke his nose. He will probably be transferred to an eastern Oregon prison for his own protection. Brad has appealed his conviction. In the spring of 1995, the proceeds from Brad's Houston suit were dispersed. After his legal fees, he had something more than $600,000 left. Secured creditors and others in his bankruptcy got all but $200,000. Garvey, Schubert & Bearer, Cheryl's law firm, had spent twice that amount to sue him civilly. "We split what was left with Cheryl's sons," Greg Dallaire said. "We'll hold it in trust for them." Brad got nothing at all. The taxpayers of the state of Oregon took a heavy hit from the cost of Brad's defense. The entrepreneur, now indigent, defendant's attorneys cum legal advisors, and his private investigator cost the state $261,435. That amount did not include the general costs of his lengthy trial. Sarah Gordon wants her sons to remember the mother they lost. She has asked all of Cheryl's family to write down their memories of Cheryl and to send pictures and videos so that Jess, Michael, and Philip will know what a wonderful woman their mother was and how very much she loved them. On January 4, 1996, Brad Cunningham had a telephonic prison term hearing before the new Oregon State Parole Board, Diane Middle, Ann Kelly, and John Kopik, and asked to have his minimum sentence reduced to 10 to 14 years. He argued that his education would prevent him from repeating a crime of passion, if indeed he were guilty. Dr. Sarah Gordon presented stacks of letters containing thinly veiled threats from Brad, and D.A. Scott Upham stressed the extreme indifference Brad had shown for human life the night of the murder, both for Cheryl and others on the Sunset Highway. The parole board's decision was swift and unanimous. They cited Brad's level of anger, his high intelligence and manipulative nature, and his lack of concern for the effect of his crime upon his children when they not only upheld his minimum sentence, they added to it, denying his current 22-year parole date in advance. He now has no good time release date and no bi-yearly hearings before the parole board. In plain words, they gave Brad a true life sentence. There was only silence on Brad's end of the phone line when he heard that he would stay in prison for the rest of his natural life. At last, the terror was over for good.
The End. You've been listening to Dead by Sunset by Anne Rule, narrated by Richard Ferrone. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.